Hello, everyone, and welcome to The New Yorkers, a podcast by New York City Cop. I'm your host, Kelly Cop, a published photographer, New York City tour business owner, real estate content creator, podcaster, and above all else, a New Yorker.
Stand clear of the closing doors, please.
With me today, I have Captain Leslie Scott, who made the fastest flight from New York to London on the British Airways Concorde in under 3 hours. But above all else, Leslie is a New Yorker. And welcome to the show, Leslie. How are you doing today?
Good, thank you. Nice welcome. To see you, Kelly.
Yes, it's such an honor to speak with you again. Because okay. We spoke, you know, a couple months ago at the Intrepid.
Right, the return of Concorde Golf.
I don't remember the name of specific.
Golf Bravo Oscar Alpha Delta.
Say that again, Golf.
Golf Bravo Oscar Alpha Delta.
And did you fly that particular plane ever?
I did.
Oh,
in
really?
Fact, I flew that airplane to get the world record from New York to London back in February of 1996.
Well, that's perfect. That is perfect. So let's tell us about the world record flight. So did you have to plan for it? How long did it take to prepare for it, or how did this work?
Well, it's pretty simple, really. The day before, me and my crew flew out from London to Kennedy, and we had some very strong winds, very, very strong winds, and a fairly, for a Concorde anyway, a fairly lengthy flight time. And on the way over, we thought, well, if the winds and weather are still much the same for the return trip the next day, why don't we see if we can do something about that? And so we all went our separate ways, because I live in New York.
Right.
And I went home and they went to a hotel in the city. And the next morning we met up and the weather was still much the same. So it seemed like a good idea to have a go. So we did.
And so what was the world record time?
It was 2 hours, 52 minutes and 59 seconds. 2 hours, 52, 59. That's from takeoff to touchdown.
Wow. From takeoff from New York City. And what airport was in New York City?
Kennedy.
And then you landed at Heathrow.
London Heathrow.
And so what is the average time and speed from, you know, from New York to London on an average day when you're not doing a world record?
Oh, for Concorde, it used to be around about 3 hours and 15, something
right.
Like 3 hours, 20, that right. Sort of time. Yeah. But we had a flight plan on that particular day of 3 hours and 7 minutes. So that with the weather conditions and the route we were taking, 3 hours and 7 minutes seemed pretty quick to us.
Yeah.
We thought, well, as I said earlier, let's give it a go.
Wow. So it was kind of like off the cuff you decided to do this in a sense.
Well, not quite off the cuff. We the day before,
right.
We'd seen that the conditions were favorable.
Right.
So we decided the next day when we got into operations to, that's where we all met up.
Right.
At Kennedy. To talk to the boys behind the counter there, the ones who would talk to air traffic control for us ahead of time and produce the flight plans for us.
Right.
And my co-pilot, Tim Orchard, got in touch with his friends and colleagues who he had in air traffic control in the UK so that they would be ready for us and do whatever they could to assist us. And on the day, that really did work quite well. And if you want me to tell you the story of the flight,
yeah,
then I could tell you how they did assist us.
I'd love to hear all this.
Well, okay. So
yeah.
On the day of the record, we, as I said before, met up in the operations room at Kennedy. And the timing was good, as I said, 3 hours and 7 minutes. So we thought we'd have a go. So air traffic control were informed, local air traffic
right.
Control were informed by a guy who was, well, he's famous amongst the operations staff at Kennedy, Joe Iavarone, his name is. And he got in touch with his buddies in air traffic control and said, look, these guys are going to try to do what we were going to try to do. And can you give them any assistance? And that was the start of it. And as I said, Tim Orchard, the co-pilot, got in touch with his friends in the UK. So air traffic control essentially down the route had a good idea about what we had in mind. So the fastest way across the world is in a straight line, like everywhere, which is what's called a great circle route. Funnily enough, Concorde most of the time did follow pretty much a great circle route, not quite, but pretty close. But the straighter you can make the line, the better. And the sooner you can get up high and fast, the better. So we were accorded all the best treatment we could get out of Kennedy. They gave us runway 22 right. That's a southwesterly runway, which is a very nice runway for us to take off from. It takes us out over the ocean pretty quickly and allowed us to accelerate. Little bit of a hiccup on the way. We were blocked at 5,000 feet because there was some air traffic in the way, but never mind. They cleared us up as soon as they could. And they cleared us basically up to our cruising block altitude, which was from 50,000 feet up to 60,000 feet.
Wow.
As soon as they possibly could. And so off we went. Flat, you know, we had climbed the usual speeds of 400 knots initially, which is what? 460, 480 miles an hour, something like that. Until we broke the speed of sound, carried on climbing. But the most important thing was we were given a clearance direct, almost as we got out over the ocean to the oceanic entry point, which is up around Newfoundland, which would have taken us over the top of Nantucket Island. And when you're going supersonic, overland, it makes a lot of noise and nobody likes you if you do. So we obviously made every effort we could to be sufficiently far away from Nantucket, 20 miles, and any other land so that we didn't give them a direct supersonic boom, which is like a gunshot.
Right.
You know, it's like a shotgun. If you fire if anybody's fired a shotgun,
right,
it's a little like that, two of them in your ear. So we definitely avoided that. And we got this straight line up to just south of Newfoundland. And then air traffic control across the North Atlantic gave us a straight line as well, which is slightly unusual, but pretty good.
Right.
And that continued. We're chugging along there, Mach 2 and a little bit maybe, but Mach 2, which is, as you know, twice the speed of sound. And around about 1,350 miles an hour, we actually got a ground speed, even at that altitude where the winds are not that strong, of approaching 1,500 knots, which was 1,500 miles an hour, which is pretty good, pretty fast.
Yeah.
So the wind did help a little bit, thank goodness. And then as we're approaching the UK, the air traffic control over there, Shanwick, straightened out our route a bit more. And I decelerated at the appropriate point. A little bit of smoke and mirrors when I say that. but at the appropriate point so that we were subsonic approaching the UK, which is very important because we don't want to boom them either.
Right.
And all was working well for us because by the time we descended from our cruising altitude of something like 57,000 feet, we descended to 39,000 feet, I think it was, subsonically. And we had something like a 200 miles an hour plus tailwind.
Wow.
Which is going to help you along over the ground, which proved to be very helpful. We were given straight lines yet again. And then we were cleared to descend towards Heathrow. And I delayed it and delayed it and delayed it so that when I started the descent, I was able to take advantage of a way of descending later and faster by using reverse thrusters in the air. We could use two of them in the air to allow us to descend like a brick, frankly, which was very handy. And we even had a competitor airliner in the way, and and they were invited to step to one side and let us by, and they very kindly did, which I thought was very generous of them. But the big change of all, the biggest advantage of all for us was Heathrow. Now, when we left Kennedy, we're flying to the east, right? when we left Kennedy, the landings at Heathrow were to the east, which would have enabled us to fly straight in and land. By the time we were approaching Heathrow, they changed to westerly landings, which made it rather difficult because that would have added several minutes to the time. So I suspect, thanks to Tim Orchard's prior calls, the air traffic controllers at Heathrow were very obliging and allowed us to land the only aeroplane to land to the east at that moment. We landed on, it'd be 09 right into Heathrow. So clearing everyone out of the way so we could do that, which was, again, very kind of them. And we struck the ground fairly firmly because I wanted to get the aeroplane on the ground 2 hours, 52 minutes, 59 seconds after we'd left Kennedy.
Wow.
Yeah. So that was good. We only broke the record that had been held for several years before by about a minute and a half. It wasn't a massive,
still pretty good,
massive change, but it was good enough, and it's lasted all this time and liable to last a while longer, I suspect.
Yeah. What does it feel like when you're cruising at this, Mach 2? Is that what you said?
Yes.
What does the plane feel like? And what does it feel like to decelerate too? Is it challenging? Probably a silly question. Is it challenging? Of course it is. But I mean, what does that feel like? Tell us about that.
Well, it doesn't feel any different to anything else when you're flying at that altitude with nothing to compare your speed against. It's
okay.
You're just moving along like you are in any other airplane. So the only time you can see that you're moving faster is when you're flying. We were at 50 to 60,000 feet and the subsonic traffic was below us, contrailing perhaps. We could see them and we'd just be going straight past them. So you could see there. Sometimes we saw our colleagues going in the opposite direction and that would be very interesting. I mean, it'd be a long way away, but I mean, even so, you could see the speed, the relative speed was quite interesting. But no, it didn't feel any different. Going through the sound barrier was a non-event.
So is there two, I really don't know. Do you break the sound barrier twice, right? When you're taking off and landing?
Yes.
Is that correct?
Yes. No, when you
so to speak.
When your speed gets up to the speed of sound.
Right.
I think the speed of sound's a good concept to discuss, actually.
Yeah, I do too.
the speed of sound is important, isn't it? I mean, the fact that I'm speaking and someone over there would be listening, they'd see if it was a long way away, they'd see my lips moving before they heard the sound arrive. So sound moves around a mile every 5 seconds, something. So if you hear 4 seconds, maybe 4 to 5, I never get the number exactly right. But if you see lightning and start counting 1, 2, you can then know how far away the lightning is by just counting. So that really means that the air, as far as I'm concerned, I'm speaking, the air is being bumped, molecules are bumping into each other and they're reaching the far side of the room and you hear me. If I'm moving an aeroplane or any vehicle through the air ahead knows you're coming because you're bumping into the air molecules, which are moving ahead at the speed of sound, and telling the air ahead to get out of the way, something's coming.
Love this.
If you're flying at the speed of sound, the air doesn't know you're coming. So you're squeezing all those molecules together, causing the temperature to rise, causing them to have to get out of the way in a bit of a rush, which causes a bang. And then the air passes over the aeroplane or the machine that's going at the speed of sound and passes off the back and the air goes, oh, thank goodness for that. and bangs again. So you get a double bang. You get a boom, boom.
Right.
So if you ever hear a supersonic aeroplane go by, you'll hear a boom, boom.
Let's take a quick break.
Hey there, I'm Bellamy Young. I'm an actor and a producer. I've been working with the global humanitarian organization, CARE, and I am so excited to invite you along for my new podcast, She Leads with CARE. Each week, you'll meet some incredible women who have changed their lives and their communities.
We raise our voices for people who don't raise their voices to defend themselves.
Listen to She Leads with CARE now on your favorite podcast platform. New episodes every Tuesday.
I did hear it a couple of times because I lived in Florida for almost 30 years, and the shuttle would go up and then we would hear it.
Yeah. Oh, gosh. Yeah, you certainly would that. Yeah. And coming back.
Right. Exactly. I would be sitting at home and I'd hear the house would rattle. Yeah. Boom, boom, boom. You know, the shuttle must be coming or going.
Yeah. I mean, I heard we had an arrangement where we go on the QE2 and give talks. The QE2, Queen Elizabeth II, you know, the ship.
Right.
Cunard. And so we talked to Concorde passengers who were going to fly the opposite way. So we give talks, but Concorde would go over the top because it followed much the same route. And you'd hear this gunshot, boom.
Right. You know. This is fascinating to me. Your life is fascinating.
Well, no, the sonic boom's important. You know, it's it disallowed the aeroplane from flying over most land masses. I mean, there's even today, no corporate aeroplane manufacturers are very interested in producing a supersonic jet for business, corporate business, because a lot of the corporate business is over land and they can't fly supersonic. So what's the point of producing one of these things at vast expense? Although there is a good program going, which is not corporate. It's a company called Boom, B-O-O-M, which looks as though it's doing succeeding quite well in getting to the point where they will produce a supersonic transport, which is very exciting. I don't know when it'll be. It's probably 7 or so years away. But now on the supersonic front, so that rather limited our routes. The airplane Concorde was designed. I mean, a little bit of history about Concorde might be of interest to you.
I was going
to
ask you, when did it start? Like, when did it start flying the Concorde?
Yeah, well, we go back a long way. In the Second World War, back in the 40s, the British were interested in producing a supersonic aeroplane. So the history is really, if we think back to the Second World War, as I mentioned, the British were interested. But the breakthrough came with Chuck Yeager when he flew, just around about my birthday actually, a rocket aeroplane, Bell X-1. Was on the 14th of October, 1947. And I was born on the 20th. So that was pretty prescient, wasn't it? So he got up to Mach 1.06. But then in the 50s, both the British and the French were pursuing separate projects to come up with a supersonic transport aeroplane. But then in the early 60s, the British and the French decided to get together. And they signed a deal so that they could both together manufacture a supersonic jet. And the intention really was to produce a supersonic airplane that would be transatlantic. And Concorde proved to be that. There's a little bit of a story here too, in that the British and the French at that time, they've never been always the best of friends. And the British didn't really trust the French in that they made them sign a no-break clause. But then there was a change of government in Britain and the British wanted to pull out because they didn't have any money. And the French insisted on the no-break clause and wouldn't let the British pull out, which I thought was great. Love that. So anyway, the manufacturers were British Aircraft Corporation and SUD. And there was, you know, it was great stuff. They produced these aeroplanes in the 60s. And then in 1969, after, by the way, the Russians produced a very similar airplane, the Tu-144. And I can tell you something about that airplane in a minute if you like.
Yes.
But the British produced this airplane and the first one flew out of France. Anyway, it was in 1969, on March 1969. And then the British flew theirs in April 69. From the UK. And then the first man on the moon was on the 20th of July, 1969. So it's quite a busy year, 1969.
Right. I was 1 year, 1 year old in 1969.
Oh, you were? Some people would say that the Concorde program project was really Europe's space shot. Of course, the Americans were also in the program too. The Americans were in the process of producing a supersonic aeroplane. They went through a number of designs. Boeing got involved and others, but they were going to have a swing wing at one point, and then they went for the delta wing, but it was going to be a much bigger aeroplane that they wanted to fly faster as well. But politics got in the way, money got in the way, and it got cancelled, which was a really sad thing, frankly. It would have been great to have had an American supersonic transport as well. But then the challenge became the moon for America, right?
Yeah, that's so true.
It was lots of people wanted to buy it. But then we had the oil crisis in the early 70s, and that sort of killed it. There were only 14 airplanes produced for operation.
14 Concorde?
Concorde, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Seven to British Airways and seven to Air France. That was it. No more.
And then they flew from, you said, what year did they start, basically?
Well, they had about 7 years. It was 1976, mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's basically
very
when they started
question,
flying.
Kelly, yes. The 69 was the first flight, the test flights. But then they had 7 years of testing, 5,000 hours on each airplane, which is an awful long time. 7 years of testing before the first commercial flights in 1976, both the same. One went off to South America and one went off to towards Bahrain, yeah.
And then they flew until when?
2003.
And that was when the accident happened in Paris, correct?
Well, no, the action was 2000.
Oh, it was 2000.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. In 2000, I was on it then, of course, not that one. Thank goodness.
So yeah,
Air France crashed, yeah, in 2000. And that was all very sad.
And did you?
Grounded.
Did you know people? Were you?
No.
Oh, you didn't know anyone?
No. Completely different companies. The Air France operated their aeroplane their way, and we operated our aeroplane our way. And never the twain shall meet. It was just a very, it's like that in the airline world, you know, we're sort of competitors and compadres, but I think the competitor comes first. And anyway, no, there was no liaison that I know about until later.
Can you tell our audience what happened, why it stopped flying? Because some people may not know why it stopped flying.
Well, that was because of the crash in 2000.
Mm-hmm. In Paris. And what was the cause? Do you know what the cause was?
The cause, it's a very difficult one. That the initial thoughts were the cause. What actually happened
Or what
was
happened,
this.
Yes.
The airplane was running down the runway. Mm-hmm. The tire was stripped. The casing of the tire was stripped. The airplane was full of fuel. And the tire blew up and hit the underside of one of the fuel tanks, which was full to bursting, and punched a hole.
They
punched a hole in the bottom, and sadly, the fuel poured out, which would be fine under normal circumstances, but the fuel ignited. Where no one's absolutely certain why, but it was probably connected with an electrical problem in the gear well.
Right.
That somehow sparked it, and basically that was that.
Yeah, I remember the photos.
It was awful.
Yeah, it's terrible. I definitely remember that. Well, is the Concorde going to fly again?
No.
No, you don't? No. Definitely not?
Definitely not. I think the airplane had a good run. It was probably coming towards the end of its lifespan.
Right.
Not towards the end. It needed a major overhaul. Mm-hmm. And that major overhaul, I don't know whether many airlines could have afforded to do it.
It's so interesting. Can I ask you some? I'm going to ask you some questions.
Yeah, go ahead.
I want to get to know a little bit more about you, unless you have a little bit more you want to add about the Concorde.
No, I'm here.
Yeah.
I'm
so fascinating. Jay, do you have any questions right now?
Mm.
So fascinating. So where were you born, Leslie?
I was born in Edinburgh, Scotland in 1947, as I said before, yeah.
Yeah, and when did you move to New York City and why?
I moved to New York City. Well, not New York City, but into New York because a very beautiful young woman came up to the flight deck one day and we met. This was on a 747 when I was flying the 747. And Teresa was her name, is her name. And we got on really well. We went out that evening. Actually, the crew, the co-pilot and myself went out with Teresa and we had a very good evening. And then we continued the relationship and eventually I moved over here. I was coming here a lot anyway.
Right.
On the 747. And we got married a couple of years later. Yeah. So that seemed like a good idea to come and live here.
What year did you move here, you said?
I started to live here in 93. But 95 we got married, yeah.
And so now you live here in Manhattan. as we talked about earlier before the show. And so how many years have you lived in New York?
Well, in New York proper or New York, Manhattan? I mean, Westchester. Yeah,
you lived in Westchester.
Westchester. Mm-hmm. I've been there since 93, but in Manhattan since 2010.
So you've lived in New York State, so to speak, and you have not, you're not back in Scotland or anything.
No, I've got family in the UK.
You've been a New Yorker for a long time.
Yeah.
It's good to know.
Yeah.
So you just mentioned the 747. I was going to ask you, what did you fly before you flew the Concorde?
That.
And how long did you fly the 747?
Well, twice I flew it. I flew it, if my career in brief, I started on a thing called the VC-10 back in 1968 with BOAC, which was the equivalent of a 707 type size airplane. I flew that for a number of years. And then I moved on to the 747, where I became a training pilot and eventually a manager and project pilot and so on. And then got my captaincy on a thing called a BAC-111. I don't know if you've ever heard of those, which is a short haul up and down jet, you know, local stuff. And then I moved back to the 747, where I met Teresa. Mm-hmm. And then on to Concorde.
So what's the difference? I know there's, I don't even know how to ask this. You know, what's the difference in between flying the 747 and the Concorde? And which do you prefer? And which is easier? A lot of questions.
And they're never easy to answer, these questions. Each has its own challenge, should we say. And there is the pleasures to fly with them all. I mean, the 747 was a real delight to fly. I mean, a wonderful aeroplane. It went everywhere too. So that, from a professional pilot's point of view, was a real bonus for me in British Airways. We went everywhere in the world, basically. So that was real, because I loved the travel aspect of it. But also, big aeroplane, big crew, managing a big crew was always enjoyable. Flying the aeroplane was a delight. Concorde, an absolute challenge. 6-month course, highly technical, like an old sports car, and it went wrong a few times, and you'd have to keep it straight and so on, straight and narrow. So, you know, so that was more of a challenge. I mean, it was every pilot's dream probably to fly a Concorde, but whether the lifestyle would suit every professional pilot is another story, because it was a fairly limited lifestyle. It was essentially a North Atlantic aeroplane. We did charters all over the place, but the main business was backwards and forwards across the North Atlantic. Oh, I should add, by the way, about the Intrepid. Did we mention the Intrepid earlier?
I don't know. That's where Leslie and I met.
It's on the Intrepid.
We
did talk about Concorde coming.
It came in, but we didn't. I don't know if we said the Intrepid. Yes.
Yes, the Intrepid. Yeah, because they've done a fantastic job.
They did. Taking care
of that aeroplane. Oh boy, and all the donors that poured money in, I'm sure, to fix it up, did a great job. In fact, I think the opening is later in May.
Yeah.
The official opening.
The Intrepid Museum brought the Concorde in, and they restored it, correct?
Well, yeah, they had it. They had it since 2003 or 2005, something like that.
It's a beautiful plane that you flew.
That was one I got the record in, yeah.
Yeah.
And so I have a good relationship with them.
They're great.
Great, great people. It's a great place to go.
I think everybody should go to the Intrepid, because I went there. I've been there a few times now, but this is the first time I saw the Concorde when I met you there came in, because it's so recent and it's really, really cool. So have you always wanted to be a pilot your whole life?
No. My father was a pilot in the Second World War, but he died when I was very young, so I didn't really get to know him. And my mother, desperate for a wayward boy to get going in life, suggested that maybe I should try. So I went to the Air Force in Britain and did okay. And they said they'd sponsor me to learn to fly, which is very nice of them, with no strings attached. So I did that. And then the airlines, it was called BOAC and BEA, they were the forerunners of British Airways, were looking for pilots because there was a shortage of pilots. You know, the Air Force was shrinking, et cetera. So the normal supply was disappearing. So they sponsored people like me to join the airline. So that's what I decided to do. So that's why I became a pilot, simply because I didn't want to go to university, and I thought this would be a great life. Travel the world, and good.
Well, tell us about your regular day as a pilot on the Concorde. Like, how does that work? You get up, And then you
okay? Yeah,
work.
Well, yeah, because you arrive at the reporting center usually about 2 hours before your departure time, and you go have a pretty thorough briefing as to the weather and passenger load, who's on board, da di da, because there's always a few famous people traveling. Then after that, we sort of go out to the aeroplane about an hour and a half before departure. The engineer would take care of the all the checks, you know, looking around the outside, because it's a three-man crew. There's a pilot, captain, rather, co-pilot and a flight engineer.
Generally the same?
No, we mixed. There was, in total, there were only 73 captains.
Wow.
In total throughout its whole, from 76 until 2003. So there weren't very many. We had about 20 captains at a time on the aeroplane. So we'd all mix co-pilots, engineers. And yeah, and then the co-pilot would do all the internal checks. And I just swan around speaking to people, saying hello, you know, go up to the passenger lounge where they were all waiting and speak to them there, go and speak to all the people and make an announcement or two. And then I'd get on the airplane, we'd start it up, fire it up and go.
Nice. How many passengers are on the Concorde?
Maximum 100, maximum.
And is the Concorde cramped or spacious?
Sideways, not
right.
It's a little bit cramped, but legroom, plenty. Headroom, if you're tall and wide, get the aisle seat because it's a bit tight.
How about the bathroom? Was it big or small?
Yeah, it's just standard.
Oh, you know what that makes you? Did you have your own quarters as a pilot? You know,
no.
Like a 747, right? You would have your own quarters.
Sure, yes. But that's because they go on for a long time. We've
right.
been up in the air long enough.
That's what I was going to say. Because you're in this for, that's what I was thinking. You're in for a short amount of time, so you don't really need quarters to sleep in.
No.
And so what was the food like on the Concorde?
Fabulous.
Was it really, really good?
Top notch, yes. It was really the best. And the wines too. I used to travel passenger sometimes, so I can swear that the wines were quite nice.
I bet. I think that would be be really fun to fly on the Concorde as a guest or a, what are they called? As a passenger, I should say.
Yep.
And, you know, I'm sure there was celebrities on the plane, like you said, because, you know, it's expensive, right? And who are, you know, the food I'm sure was amazing. You probably pop them bottles of wine and champagne. And what celebrities did you meet on the Concorde?
Well, there would be quite a few. My favorites were the Stones and the Beatles and guys like Clapton, Peter Townsend, people like that. You know, Pavarotti was there once,
oh,
too,
wow.
on one of my flights.
Luciano.
Yeah, yeah.
Every person you mentioned on there, I would love to meet, too.
Oh, yeah. Well, the great George Harrison, bless him, no longer with us, but of the Beatles, came up one day with his video camera. He got a new video camera and was waving around in the flight deck saying, you know, what a great privilege it was to be there and all that. He was really a really decent guy. But lots of people. I mean, there's Kristen Scott Thomas, Gwyneth Paltrow,
yeah.
Madonna.
How was Madonna?
Lovely. She came up with her youngest child, eldest child, sorry.
Rocco?
Is it?
I think it's Rocco.
Is it?
And, it's funny, I know that.
I don't know, but she's lovely. She was just standing at the door there, and she didn't want to come in, really. Just, everything, how's it going? All right? Everything okay?
Oh, that's really cool.
It's really sweet. Yeah, Diana Ross, Mariah Carey.
Wow.
Michael Jackson, Sting, Patrick Stewart, you know, Jean-Luc Picard from Star Trek. Elton John, he was on there all the time.
Wow, how cool is that, too?
Sam Press, John McEnroe, people like that. Bruce Willis, bless him, he was there, too. Lots of them. Let me think of some others. Lou Reed, Walter Cronkite.
Cronkite.
Yoko Ono was there.
Any royalty?
Yes, the royal family of Kuwait were there.
Wow.
I never flew our queen.
Right.
That was always a management thing. I never got to do that. Sultan of Oman was on there. Queen Noor of Jordan. She came up on, not came
it's
up.
It's amazing, isn't it?
Warren Buffett was there.
Wow.
These are on my flights.
Right.
Rupert Murdoch, people like that. Fayed. Yeah, no, it was great. There were all sorts of people.
So did you have any difficult passengers?
Actually, yes. And I think he's in prison now, isn't he?
This is good.
Well, I'm not sure. Is Harvey Weinstein still around?
I think he's alive, right? In prison, right?
I thought so.
So you had him on your...
Yeah, he was... When I say difficult, he was very demanding in that he loved to smoke.
Yeah.
And that proved a bit awkward when there was no smoking on the
airplane. Yeah, I bet.
And it never caused me any problems, but I do know some people had some issues. But dear old Harvey, yes. And no, I don't think I had any really difficult passengers. They were all just... It was a bit like a club, to be perfectly honest. Most people thought it was terrific to be there. Excited to be there.
I bet.
Some of them used it as the subway to get from New York to London.
Wow.
On a weekly basis, David Frost, you probably heard of him. Mm-hmm. Yeah. He, I know when he was doing an interview show, I think he traveled backwards and forwards on a weekly basis. A lot of people did. Yeah. On a weekly basis.
Wow.
One guy even, Lord Hanson, I'm sure he's no longer with us, but he justified flying on Concorde because this is cell phones were around, but they weren't that big and they certainly couldn't use them on the airplane. The amount of time he saved, because a regular flight would be about 8 hours from London to New York, and we did it in 3.5, you know. So
wow.
the time he saved at his hourly rate justified the ticket.
So the average flight time then was 3.5 hours?
For us.
Yeah.
Going that way. 3:25. Oh. Yeah, not flight time, but from chock to chock. So when you push back from the gate and arrived at the gate the other end, it'd be about 3 hours. Hours 30 that way.
You know, so only a few airports in the world could accommodate the Concorde as well, correct? Or am I wrong?
No, quite a few could. We needed a decent runway length. You know, we went to a lot of places, to lots mm-hmm. of different places.
I didn't realize that.
We could go. I even went up. I was a training pilot on Concorde mm-hmm. as well. So I taught new people. I also taught the teachers to teach as well. So Stuart, you know the airport Stuart in Northern New York?
I don't.
Yeah, Stuart. So that's, it's just up there off. Just to the west of the river there, Hudson. Stuart, what's the full name? I can't remember. But anyway, Stuart is, I did a few circuits up there with someone who was coming back onto the airplane, and we came back over where I used to live up in Katona, just over the top, made a bit of noise. On July the 4th, woke a few people up.
That's pretty cool. So I just have a couple more questions. I'm at the end of my questions, but any medical emergencies ever on the Concorde?
On Concorde, no, thank goodness. But certainly on other airplanes I did have, yeah, but not on Concorde, no. No, no. I mean, there's no time for a medical emergency.
Right, no time.
We've got something, we'd be there on the other side.
So once you get to the, you know, your highest altitude, you're ready to come back down maybe, right?
Well, the way it goes is this. You know, we had a cruise climb technique. Mm-hmm. So whereas most airplanes fly at one fixed level,
right,
and go up or down, we would be cleared to go whatever level we liked. And so when the airplane got lighter, it tended to drift up. But if it got warmer as we were drifting up, it would drift down again. So we'd be drifting up and down.
This is fascinating.
Between 50 and 60,000 feet.
And
so that was what... So we just had full power blasting the whole way.
Wow.
Yeah. Now, we used the same amount of fuel as a 747 would use to get across the North Atlantic.
Really? You didn't burn more fuel than the 747?
Well, no. 747 could carry 350 passengers and we carried...
Oh, 100. I gotcha. Yeah.
So economically, it wasn't necessarily such a great thing. But even so, yeah, we burned a lot of fuel. In fact, on takeoff, we could carry about 200,000 pounds of fuel. And on takeoff, we were burning 200,000 pounds of fuel an hour at that rate because we were just... We had reheats.
Right.
Afterburners, we call them over here, I think.
That's so fascinating.
We'd be chucking fuel out the back, yeah. So it wasn't very economic.
What's the view out the front of the window of the Concorde compared to a 747? Is it the same, or I mean, you can see this the space in space too,
that's,
right?
That's a very good point. No, if you look out the window and straight up at altitude, it was black. It wasn't blue because we're on the very edge of the atmosphere.
Right.
So you're looking up, it's black, yeah. And if you're lucky and the weather's good, you could just about make out the curvature of the Earth.
And the passengers, could they see the sky too? I mean, the space,
Space. So if you just press your head against the window and look up, you'd be black. Yeah. But, I mean, generally looking out straightforward, no, it was the same on both airplanes, except on Concorde. Of course, as you know, we could lower the nose.
Right.
Because if we couldn't lower the nose, we couldn't see out to land because we had such a high angle of attack on the way in. But when you're supersonic, you want to be as sharp as and pointy as you can be. So we always had the nose raised, and there'd be a big glare shield as well to streamline it. So if you ever go to Concorde and have a look and get on board, you'll see what it looked like when you were supersonic.
I need to go back to the Intrepid now because just to walk on the Concorde and see where you've been, first of all. And then just, I want to see the space inside and pretend.
It's open now.
Yeah, it is.
It's open now.
I pretend I'm on the plane and Leslie is our pilot.
Well, maybe if you come along on is it the 14th? I think it is. Is it May the 14th?
I think so. Yeah.
I'll be there.
Anybody bring their pets on there? Any celebrities bring their pets? Because
not as far as I'm aware. No. I don't actually recall what our policy was as far as that's concerned, but I don't think so. No, I don't think so.
No. You know, celebrities have their posh pets that they have to have with them all the time.
Yeah, so. I don't recall. There may have been, but I don't remember any.
Leslie, talking with you today has been such a pleasure and an honor, and it's fascinating. I could talk to you for hours. We can make this like a 5-hour podcast. No joke. But before we do let you go, we here at the New Yorkers want to know why you, Leslie Scott, are a New Yorker.
I'm a New Yorker because I have family here, first of all. I also have family abroad, but I've got family here in New York. I love the city. It's the most dynamic city, one of the most dynamic cities I've ever been in. But to live in, it's got everything you could want, really. You've got this open air. You've got the buzz of the city life. It's got all the arts and culture you could hope for. It's a very, very exciting place to live. Yeah, so I'm very happy to be here. I wish the taxes were a bit less sometimes. But it is what it is. You pay for what you get, I suppose. Yeah. So we love it here. Yeah.
I love that. That's great. Thank you for joining us today for this week's episode of the New Yorkers podcast. Why don't you let everyone know, Leslie, where they can find you on social media?
Well, I'm not a huge social media person. I'm not on Facebook, but I occasionally post on Instagram at Papa Zoom Zoom. So that's where I am on Instagram.
Are you on Facebook or anything too, or just Instagram?
No, not on Facebook. No.
Papa Zoom Zoom. That's great.
Zoom Zoom comes from my English daughter who wanted to get a name for her children, my grandchildren, to call me something, a name. And we decided on Zoom.
Nice.
It's sort of appropriate, don't you?
Yeah. Perfect.
Given what I've been doing all my life.
You've been zooming pretty fast around the world, yeah. I can tell you that for sure. Once again, I'm your host, Kelly Kopp, also known as New York City Kopp across all my social media. That would be Threads, Facebook, Twitter or X, and Instagram.
Wow, quite a collection. So please like and subscribe to the New Yorkers podcast. And you can follow the New Yorkers on social media at the New Yorkers podcast.
You can leave a rating or comment to let us know how you are enjoying the show. We read through all your comments and DMs, so please, we would love to hear from you. And thank you, Roxana Rosado and Frankie Fran Hendrani and Sue Abril for your kind words on the last episode. If you want to be featured at the end of an episode, leave a rating on Apple Podcasts or a comment on Spotify.
And thank you, Valeria Van Bockum, Jojo Hanna, and Mickey Sisk, Sr., for your comments on Facebook.
Have a lovely day, my friends, and we will see you next Sunday.
Goodbye.
This is the last stop on this train. Everyone, please leave the train. Thank you for riding with MTA New York City Transit.